Blog Talk Radio.
I'm going to bring Jay Logan on today. Our guest is Kimberly Jackson. She is a flautist, a vocalist, a composer, a DJ, a producer, and a music educator. And I know all of those things in one. It was hard to get out. So we're going to really have an exciting time with her today because we're really going to get into the ins and outs of the music industry and what's happening in music today and how music really can shift the direction of the world, you know. So without further ado, I'm going to bring on Mr. Jay Logan and Mr. Jay, or Mr. Logan, or Mr. Jay, or Mr. Logan, are you there? Mr. Logan, are you there? Hello, Mr. Logan. I think we're having some difficulties here. We can't seem to hear him. Mr. Logan, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. I'm definitely here. I'm just helping KJ get online, and but I'm here. Yeah, I'm here. And so it's wonderful to be back on our beautiful show here. And you, well, I don't want to say all the stuff that's happened over the weekend. I'm gonna let you.
We can't tell everybody. We can't. We're not going to tell them at all about it on this show, Jay. We're going to let them read about it. What do you think about that? And we'll tell them about it next week. Okay. Because you know we got to go through a little bit of our stuff to see what we want out there or not. But we have some exciting stuff to tell you about, Jay. Oh my God! Like it was just an exciting. Oh, my God, exciting weekend. Now, Jay, I've seen KJ come on here a couple of times and then blank out. So the next time she comes on, I'm just going to try to bring her in. But we're really super excited. Maybe we might have to call her. What do you think?
I'm going to bring her in on my line. How about that? She's calling right now. I'll bring her in.
Yeah, let's do that, sir.
Okay. Okay, y'all, she's with us. Hello?
Well, hello, Miss Jackson. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm okay. I just want you to know that you're on live with our audience around the world, and we're ready to go. Now, Miss Jackson, everyone, I want you to know this is Kimberly Jackson. Okay, and she is a flautist, a vocalist, a composer, a DJ, a producer, and a music educator. And we're going to go in all those areas with her today. Kimberly, I must ask of you, though, we don't want you to give out all the goodies too soon, okay? So we ask that you tailor your answers to the questions so that you don't give out all the good stuff. Is that okay?
That's fine.
Good, because, you know, we want to get as much of you
That's
as
fine.
We can. And with all of these things that you do, you know, we got to get it in, okay? So, Kimberly, you know, we're gonna get right into it with you. Now, it's very rare to have all of this in one person, okay? So that means your creativity is on a level that is just completely amazing, okay? And with that said, we want to go a little bit back to the beginning, okay? When you were just a little girl, okay, growing up in Los Angeles, okay, and you started your classical training at 12, okay, before you even hit 12, it seems like you already knew what you wanted to do. I mean, was this something that was, like, was music just there for you? When did you know personally that you wanted to go into music?
Well, I really started playing music formally at 5. And I started on the clarinet. Okay, but before the clarinet, I was just around in my mama's house pulling the pots and pans out from her cupboard and beating on those like a drum and she used to watch, my mother liked classical music, so she used to watch symphony orchestras, programs on TV. And I would try to, you know, imitate the conductor when I was a little bitty. So my mother even said that, you know, I was trying to do music when I was in my diapers. So I think I came out of the womb knowing that that's who and what I am.
Okay. Okay. Well, I know Jay has a question for you.
Okay.
Yes, I do have a question. So, when did you figure out that you wanted to play an instrument? Out of the womb or when you were 7? Or when did you figure out?
You know, okay, I think I can, yeah. The answer to that, I think I've always wanted to play an instrument, but my first awareness or really being cognizant of wanting to play an instrument was when my father... One of the very few memories that I have of being with my father, we went to the Watts Christmas Parade down in L.A., and my father had me on his shoulders, and we were watching the marching bands go by, and I saw the young people. Of course, they didn't look like young people to me. They looked like grown-up or whatever, because I was just a little bitty, and I had a bottle of Orange Crush, in my hand, and I was watching the marching band go by, and the instrument that stuck out to me, of course I didn't know the name of it at the time, was when the clarinet section marched by, and they were long and black and sleek, and they just looked like the most beautiful thing in the world to me. And so when I started school in the first grade, I remember they used to take everybody into a band room or something, and you could look at all the instruments in their cases and choose an instrument. And I chose the clarinet. So I would say around 4 or 5 years old, that's when I knew I wanted to play something.
Hmm. That's interesting. You know, I have some of our ambassadors, our children ambassadors, have played clarinet, the ebo, and the violin, okay? And one of the things, the flute, one of our other youth ambassadors plays the flute. I'd like to know when you started coming in connection to realize you wanted to play the flute and you realized you had a gift with it. Because some people, and if you would share with our audience how you connected with that, because many of our, people who are interested in playing instruments, okay, KJ, they're not sure where to get started or where to go, or even, you know, if they can go for training, they don't know where to start. And being that you're also a music educator, I felt that you could actually, you know, kind of chime in and share with us how you got your start of getting connected with that instrument of the flute, and how other youth or even older people, especially even older people, can get, you know, up to speed on playing an instrument for the first time or following back up with an instrument that they played as a young person. Can you give us some insight into that?
Okay. Well, for me, I grew up in a time when music was a part of education. It was just a basic part of your public education. It wasn't, everybody had to, you know, at least try an instrument. It was just a part of your education, like you took math and history and reading and, you know, all of that. And so, when, like I said, I started playing instruments at five and getting, you know, a basic education in it. But, you know, at least here in America, that's not a fundamental part of the education system. So you kind of have to work a little bit harder with your kids to find how you can find out about learning how to play instruments. And but it is still possible. It's still very possible. You know, if you want to play an instrument, whatever that instrument is, and but I'll say this, sometimes in the beginning, some kids don't know. You know, they kind of get pushed into it by their parents. Or some kids don't know what they want to play. They just have some kind of a connection with music. And so you start with an instrument, and then you move. Maybe that instrument don't connect with that particular instrument. So you move to another instrument and to another instrument. For me, like I said, I started out on the clarinet. I played the clarinet until the third grade. Then I started playing drums for a minute. And I started on bass drum and moved up to the snare drum and the concert band. And then in the fifth grade, when we used to, at that time, you graduated from sixth grade and then you went to junior high school. So I had already been kind of looking at the flute section, you know, while I was playing drums. But I was looking at the flute section and, wow, those are really pretty. And, you know, it kind of felt like I was cheating on my drums, but I really kept looking over there. And then in junior high, when I was auditioning to be in the drum section in the junior high band, just wasn't good enough. But I made a deal with the band teacher. I've been making deals with teachers and whatever forever. And I made a deal with the band teacher that if I could learn to play the flute by the end of the semester and challenge his first chair flute player, if I win that challenge, can I be in the band? And he said, yeah, because he didn't believe that I would be able to do all that. So I went through beginning wins on flute, learned, but what he didn't know is that I had already played clarinet for 3 years, so I knew how to read music. I just needed to know the fingerings and how the armature worked on the flute. And once I got that going, then it was cool. And, you know, fortunately, I did win that challenge, and I stayed first chair in the band for my whole 3 years of junior high school and then also in high school. But that's how it was for me.
Interesting.
Wow.
So I want to know the challenges that you had as being a musician and being a woman trying to be a musician, you know, because that's kind of a hard thing as being a little girl and you're trying to be, you know, in this band with all these guys. And I want to know how hard was that?
Okay, can I get a clarity on that question? Are you talking about school or are you talking about professionals?
Just in general, in school too, because, you know, if you take pigtails, they'll come, you know, want to pull your hair and stuff. We the guys too. So I want to know, like, was it hard or was it easy being, most of the saxophone players and the drummers are kind of guys. And, like Shooter E was telling me, it was kind of hard for her, you know, because, you know, she's playing the drums, and, you know, most of the drummers are dudes, you know. So I just wanted to know, was that a challenge? And do you see the world, is it a better world today for us in general? You don't have to be all, you know, exact, but just give us an overview, you know.
Okay. Well, as a student, as a music student, I think because I played the flute, it wasn't really that much of a, I don't really remember any getting any grief from the fellas or the band teachers. Nobody was, you know, they always got a lot of encouragement, and I was very good. Early on, and so I think the only problem I had was I got a little bit too much ego going when I was a youngster, and I should have been a little bit more humble at that time. But the difficulties really began when I started playing outside of school and began pursuing playing professionally. I think my first gig, I was 15 or 16 years old, and I played with played a gig at the Hungry Hunter or some, you know, really upscale restaurant in Century City in Los Angeles. And played the gig, and I was, you know, the youngest person in the ensemble, but I could read really well, because I was the only person in the ensemble that read every day, read music every day, because that's, you know, we do in music school or in classes or whatever. And so I was reading, and even though the music wasn't very familiar to me, I could sight read really, really well. So I could just play it, see it, play it, and go, oh, okay, this is what this sounds like. And so I started, that's when I first started playing charts and jazz charts. Just meant for ensemble. And in that experience, playing that gig and getting paid, you know, the little money, whatever the money was that we got paid at that time, I dug it. I dug the audience, you know, the applause, the appreciation, that the applausement that the people were appreciating what, you know, what I was doing, but also I liked the challenge of, you know, playing with these older cats and realizing that I'm right there with them, you know, and in some cases, passing them and my ability to sight read. And so that was cool. And then as time went on, and I realized, okay, this is something that I really want to do professionally, then the challenges really started coming about when I started getting approached to play more so professionally, to be put out front. Early, I would say, you know, in the 80s, there was the image thing, which is still not as prevalent, but still kind of an issue. The powers that be, whoever that magic they are, want you to look very feminine. And if you're a very feminine woman by nature, then that's not a problem. But if that's not who you really are, and you know who you really are, then that's a problem. That can be very, very problematic. And then, of course, being a woman in this industry is already difficult because it is a man's industry. And, of course, there are many issues that come along with that. I don't want to get too deep into that discussion. But I think maintaining a strong sense of self is essential. And that's why I do some challenges. I try to do the makeup thing and, you know, do the supermodel look, whatever. And I remember just looking at myself in the mirror going, who is that? I felt like I was in drag. Because that wasn't me. And it's very hard to maintain this facade and perform, you know, five nights a week or six nights a week in being something that you're not. It's hard to give your authentic self playing wise if you don't feel like your authentic self.
And so, I wanted to ask you, how about getting jobs? Did you get as many jobs as the guys? You know, do they call you? Is this,
no.
Is this something? Okay, that's what I want. Okay, that's a whole different.
I'll say this. I had to stop waiting for calls. I had to create. It became very clear to me. I had to, if I wanted to gig, if I wanted to work, I had to create my own opportunities to gig and work because they weren't going to call me.
We'd be hating them.
The fellas be hating.
Yeah, what you was going to say?
The fellas be hating. Yeah. Every so often I get a call, but I had to create my own. I had to find a way. And that's really what thrust me into the band leader.
Interesting.
Because the fellas just, you know, they might call here and there, but, you know, They don't like a pushy. They don't want a pushy sing or flautist. You know, whatever. They don't want that. And I play flute. I play flute exclusively. I'm a flautist.
You be showing us up. That's why.
Well,
you
know, play. You know, sir.
Yeah, we don't want to give her no job. We might take the show.
Well, you know, one of the things I'd like to know too. KJ, you know, listening to what you're saying and having to, you know, because often as a woman, and I don't like to get down, like you said, I want to go there because we could be on the phone forever. That's a subject I love to talk about, is the gender thing. But as a woman, you know, who took the time to, you know, for herself, when you were able to have the insight to see that they were not going to call you, you had to create your own, you know. It brings me to when I was in France in the last 2 years, and there was a woman on stage. She was a great DJ. I mean, I hadn't I know a lot of DJs, okay? And I know a couple of women DJs that are really on the money. And a lot of times, just like you said, KJ, they're called because of their beauty. I have one friend. She's been on the show before, Mary Malik. She's from Sudan. She's one of the top DJs in the world. But she's a model.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, they love that look. You know what I mean? But
yes,
I have a question for you. As someone who is a flutist, as someone who is, you know, I see that you're a DJ and
I'm
producer.
A flautist,
sorry. Forgive me. You know, my pronunciation is not that good. Don't beat me up on that one, KJ. But no, as being a flautist and being a DJ as well, and all the other hats you wear. But specifically, I want to get into that part about being a DJ and a producer as well. Kimberly, what have you faced as a woman in this industry with those wearing those two hats? Not only just the other hats you wear, but wearing those two hats. Have you faced any, you know, just any adversarial, you know, feedback from not just men, but other women in general, just in general, being a woman, that you are multi-talented in all those areas. What did they say when they saw that you were a DJ and a producer as well?
Well, okay, that's a good question. Let me back up or preface the answer by saying the DJ thing came along in the last few years. Not necessarily something that I was looking to do or really wanted to do. It just evolved out of finding, you know, gigs paying less and less and less, you know, the local gigs and stuff, and wanting to gig, but just not, the money just not being there to pay all the musicians that I needed to get the full sound that I want and need and love. And so I started playing live over tracks to, you know, so that I could at least get some decent money from the gigs that I was doing. And thusly, it evolved. So I started playing, you know, during the breaks, I would play the records that people like to hear and dance to and party to. And so the thing, it really evolved into that kind of unique DJ thing. I'm not a DJ that, you know, does the scratching and all that, the DJ stuff. But I play records, and I play with people, especially, you know, folks in my age group, they love to hear the songs that they want to hear. And then I'll throw the flute in on top of that and, you know, turn it into a whole different kind of experience. But not a whole lot of DJs are musicians, you know, so they don't really possess that skill to throw on top of what they're doing with the records. So that's still something that's in development. By being a producer, I produced my first two albums, or first two CDs, and the first one was more jazz oriented. Let Me Make Love to You. That was the title of that one. Second one was Urban Legend, moving a little closer to my funk thing that I'm really into, and I had to do a lot based on what I felt was the right thing to do. I didn't really have a mentor in the production realm. I just had folks that I admired how they did their producing, but I didn't have anybody to really teach me. There was nobody that anybody that wanted to get involved with me from a producer level, they wanted to take over. They didn't necessarily want to teach me anything. They just wanted to take over what I had going and then make it be their thing. So
interesting.
So I went with my instinct and what I wanted to do and what I felt sounded good and I've learned some things from Jay in the one single that we've done, and I learned about, he was teaching me about how to taught me after the fact. I saw where when the song was mastered, and he helped me to see where this is radio ready and this is why. I never had anybody to say that. They just say, let me take care of it, and basically you shut up and play the flute and I'll take care of everything else. But, I'm not a good shut up and play the flute kind of girl.
Well, I can get that. And, one of the things, and I hear you. And one of the things I'm hearing, too, that's very powerful is that you also said that even before meeting Jay, there were some things that you learned on your own. I want to ask you something. Through those two albums that you did, okay, what did you learn about yourself as a music artist, okay, as a musician? Because you brought that out of yourself. What did you learn about yourself that you would teach other younger people, as an educator? What would you teach them to learn about themselves that you learned? Because one thing I'm hearing is, trust yourself in what you're doing.
Yeah.
Even if you make mistakes, trust yourself.
Right. Trust your instinct. Yeah, trust your instincts. Listen to you. First of all, you got to listen to your instincts. You got to listen to that little voice inside of you that says, do this or try that. Something that I learned recently from a sister friend, and she's an on-air personality and on the radio station here, this thing about this concept called the five-second rule. And the five-second rule is you get an idea, and you have 5 seconds to act on bringing that idea to fruition, to reality. If you don't act on it in some kind of way in 5 seconds, that's when your mind, your negative mind, starts telling you all the reasons why it won't work. All the reasons why you need to leave that alone. And if you don't overcome that, that idea stays an idea. And that's it. And then somewhere along the line, you're going to see somebody else did that. Somebody else will take, because the ideas kind of float around in the universe.
Well, that's absolutely. We could get into that totally, KJ. You know that all three of us can. But one of the things is cognitive bias, and that's something we all have. We brush it to the side. When you have that idea and it comes to you, it is for you to utilize. You can get upset when you see it used down the road by someone else because you didn't jump on it. But that, like I said, that we could definitely get into that on another thing. Jay, I just want to sneak one more in here. One of the things I also want to ask you is, how the industry was when you started out, right, and where the industry is now. Now, everybody, there are some good things to the bad things.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you now. So one of the things from the time you started, KJ, and from the time where the music industry is now, a lot of people have their complaints and so forth. On some ways, the industry is better, and on some ways, the industry is worse. What do you see that the industry needs now that it does not have?
That's a good question, Joe.
That's a very good question. The more I spent time with Jay, with Mr. Logan, who, I gotta say that We started talking last year. I mean, we've kind of known of each other. I've worked with him, you know, gave me a couple of opportunities to play on some other projects with the Lounge Renown family. But we've become friends, and he's like a brother from another mother now in my life. And a lot, you know, it kind of reminds me of, you know, my first master's degree. When I walked across the stage, and I was, you know, they was putting my hood on me and they're saying, you know, congratulations, da da da, with a master's in performance and literature. And the only thing that I remember for real thinking, my most prominent thought was, I now know how much I don't know. I know how much I don't know about music. That's what that degree, and it's not so much the paper, it was the experience of acquiring the education that put the little piece of paper, because the paper is just paper. You know, all of the things, all of the classes that I had to take, all of the experiences that I went through to acquire that paper that says I have this knowledge and I have this experience and yada, yada, yada. It let me know there's so much more that I don't know. And that's what I, you know, I've learned a lot, like spending a lot of time with Jay. There's so much that I don't know. And I'm so grateful that I'm at this age. You know, I think in my 20s, I don't think Jay and I would be able to get along because I was an asshole. I mean, excuse me, I shouldn't say that. I was a jerk. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to say it the other way. You know, I was so egotistical. I just thought I knew everything. And there was nothing, you know, nobody could tell me anything. And now, you know, after living life and having life experiences and getting knocked around by life, I now am able and ready to say, wow, I don't know. I don't know. I might know some things. I do know some things, and I'm confident in what I know, but I also am teachable. And so when you ask me, what do I see in the industry that's lacking? The one thing I can say is the appreciation for real music. And real music being pushed in the industry, but I also know why that is. And it's not by accident, I don't believe. So that's what I think is lacking. I kind of been
well,
around
funny you should
to
make
say that, but yeah.
No, I totally get it, and I know Jay's got to go next. So one thing I will tell you, one of the things I learned from when I worked with Gladys Knight and mentored by Barry White and a lot of other people in the industry, so Lucian Grange and all those folks, all those names sound good. They all sound great. But it wasn't the name dropping of the names. It was learning from these people at an early age about the business of the industry. And one of the things I always found out, two things. Gladys used to always say that you don't have to wear your dress all the way up your rear end to be a lady in this industry and be proud of the talent and clear the talent, not of who you are, not of what you have, but who you are. What I learned from Lucian Grange is do what you need to do, and then the rest will follow. And those are two things I never forgot. And that sounds like so easy, but those are two things that I keep every day with me. You know, when somebody tells you can't do something, don't prove that you can. You don't need to prove that you can. You just do what you do. The less said and the more that you move forward, the better off you are because there's nothing to prove.
Mm-hmm.
So those things I've learned early on, and I believe that without the artists, we have nothing. And that's why I asked you what you felt was in this industry from here on, because without the artists, we don't have anything. I mean, the producers are great, the songwriters, you know, but without the songwriter and the person who is playing that instrument and singing, we've got nothing. Even the producer doesn't have anything. If they will use live instruments, because today they want to do something else. So, Jay, you got the floor. I know I took the floor a little bit, but I had to get in there a little bit with KJ. You were beating me up. You're beating me up there.
I love you think before because you were talking about Barry White and that with why and when you work with Barry White and that reason why I want to talk about that because you have invited me to summits before, Gail. I've been with you in a lot of conferences, and when you get there, you're extraordinary. But we had an opportunity to go to a music summit the other night, and Barry White's name came up, and the lady there was wonderful, Sayla Garrett. And they asked her, who are the five most important people if you could have done a duet? You know, you did one with Michael Jackson. And so I'll just name a couple. She said Prince, and she said Barry White. And so when you said Barry White, she wished that she had done a duet with your mentor. You know, she wished that. And by you talking about where the music has gone, she had said something extraordinary. And KJ, you remember she said, don't let anyone tell you what your music should be about. Don't follow any.
Right.
Don't follow none of the rules. If you're going to do trap, don't follow the radio. Don't give up on you, which you're trying to do. The beautiful song that you wrote, Gail, I'm Never Alone. You're doing all the right things, doing it your way, how it's done. Because if she would have did anything any other way, she wouldn't have been the person she is. She probably would have never even made it. She always just stuck by her horses and rode her horses the way she wanted it. So I just wanted to say that to it was a great summit, you know. So I just wanted to say that because Barry White's name came up. So KJ, I want to ask you this. Now you went from clarinet to flute. Okay. So
yes.
When did you find out that every flute isn't the same? You know, like when you're in grade school, they give you this old dinky con flute and it's okay, you know. So when did you realize flutes are different? Because most people think they're all the same.
Okay. When you ask that, I have a story that comes from me. And the flutes we had were called Bundy, and they were just talk about clunky, junky flutes. I didn't know that there was the flutes were different until I think the next year my band teacher had a little conference with my mom and said, you know, I think that you should get Kimberly private lessons. She's good, but she can be so much better with a private teacher. And my mom and my grandmother were very supportive, and so he also said she needs her own flute. And his wife had a flute that she wasn't doing anymore, and so we bought that flute. I don't know how much, I think, you know, maybe $100 or something. But it was a nicer flute than the ones that were at school. So at that point, that's when I knew, okay, there's a difference between flutes. But then here's something that I learned. See, I'm telling you, when the arrogance began, and then I was hanging out in high school. I was hanging out with my young man, my little boyfriend or whatever, and his father is Donald Dean. Donald Dean evidently is a great jazz drummer down in L.A., And so we're standing on the porch, and there's some other musicians also there, some other cats, you know, some other guys. And I think his daughter wanted to play the flute and asked me what kind of flute or do I need, or does she need a different flute or something like that. And I started talking about, at that point I had a Gemeinhardt. And I was saying, oh, well, you know, it's absolutely imperative to have the best flute that you can get, the best kind of flute where you can get the best sound, and yada 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 yada, and you know, this Dean is like, what is this guy talking about? I'm trying to get my daughter just a decent flute, and he's trying to, you know, I'm talking about, yeah, it's got to be $500 or more, and you know, blah 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 blah, on and on and on. Okay, so fast forward, maybe about six, 7 years, and I was starting to hang out with the musicians and going to the after-hours spot where the jazz musicians were coming in. When they were on the road, they would come to the after-hours spot down in L.A. And I met this guy to play the flute. I do not remember his name, but I remember that he had the same kind of sound and tone that Hubert Lars had. His articulation was impeccable. And when I talked to him, got close enough to talk to him, and I asked him, you know, I was just waiting for him to say, oh, I'm playing on a Powell or I'm playing on a Haynes or, you know, something like that. I found dude was playing on an old clunky Bundy closed hole instrument. And I looked at that and I looked at him and I'm like, this cannot be. This is kind of like a, just too, how can I say it? It was just too real for me because I'm like, I'm looking at this and going, it just messed up my whole philosophy about what kind of instrument you're supposed to be playing. And then I came to the natural conclusion that it is not the instrument, it is the musician. The musician makes the instrument come alive, not the other way around. Not the other way around. So you can have, I can take a Bundy flute and make it sound good. Of course, it won't be the same as a, say, as a Haynes, you know, because they're designed differently. They're designed differently. But I can take any flute and breathe life into it and make it sound decent or even a little bit better. Because it's the musician that plays instrument, not the other way around. I hope that answers the question.
Yeah,
It does.
It really does. Well, this we're running out of time, but one of the things I would really love to ask you, KJ, is one of our last questions. What is your prediction for the direction this music industry will go in now that technically labels are kind of not there, technically everything is being streamed? What are your thoughts on the direction the music industry will take?
Wow. Okay, that's another.
And we want your thoughts.
I don't know if I'm really qualified to answer that question, but I'll give it a try.
Well, we think you are very qualified to answer that.
I'm sorry?
We think you're very qualified to answer that. We think you are very qualified to answer that.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll tell you where I'd like to see it go.
Okay.
And I think it could go. I think it can go in this direction because, you know, labels they aren't as necessary as they were, let's say, in the 80s and the 70s. I think that we can now start to see more creativity in what's being produced musically. I would love to see the ingenuity and free thinking, let's say, back into jazz and R&B and the merging. What we see a lot of now is a lot of just kind of taking the R&B song and redoing it and calling it jazz. And that's, to me, what I see is we're hearing an instrumental version of R&B, of R&B hits from back in the day. I would love to see us get back to the innovative thinking and creating and recording of, say, like Stanley Clarke and, you know, well, Herbie Hancock back in the day, you know, Miles and all, where there was a lot of original composition and the focus on original composition and the appreciation and the respect for original composition. Not just, you know, another thing that we see in supposed R&B or pop music is taking snippet or samples of original of the original jam. They just take, they don't even bother to record you know, the section of a song, like a Chaka Khan song or whatever. They just snatch a piece of it and then come up with, they may even, and I'll say that they even take the same melody and just throw a couple of different words on top of it. They'll take the same melody of a song and put some different words on it and call it a new song. And unfortunately, because our populace has been, and I'll just say it honestly, dumbed down from the music perspective, and also memories shortened, and the discouraging of studying history, and of course, okay, the revisionist version of history, we have people who don't even know that the song that they're listening to is just a rehashed version of something that came before. It's not even original. So what I'd love to see, and I hope to see happen as a result of this opening up the door to being able to put music out, is the resurgence of the individual, the individuality of composers. And man, I would love to see arrangers, real arrangers, come back into vogue as far as our industry is concerned. People whose job solely is to arrange for strings. Or another cat, you know, their job is they arrange horns. Another person, their job, they arrange background vocals. They arrange, that's their thing. That's their job, to arrange. I would love to see that come back. So I hope, again, you know, that answers the question that you asked.
Yeah, that answers. I would love to see those arrangers to come back too, because I used to have an arrangement job. But anyway.
Okay.
That's where the great Gene Page, you know, the one who did a lot of stuff for Barry and Charles Stefan, those arrangers, great,
Oh, no, but they're still there. Yeah, they're still there, though. They're still heavily there. I just guess they have to, KJ, we have to have you back on because we have to get back in that conversation. You think you'll come back with us in a few weeks and talk about that?
Oh, absolutely. I'd love to. Yeah,
we'd love to have you back, and we'd definitely have you on with a few other artists from different parts of the world. We can really start jamming and getting into this.
Well, just let me know when you want, and I'm down.
Well, we're down to have you, so consider it in the next 2 to 3 weeks. We will have you back on. And, KJ, it has been a supreme pleasure to have you on our show today, and we're glad you're taking the invitation to come back, and we look forward.
Thank you.
Keep doing your thing.
Thank you for having me. Yeah, thank you for having me.
Yeah.
I appreciate it.
Oh, no problem. And, you know, when your release comes out, we're going to be rocking that out, too, and playing it here and having you back on. So we hope that you could become the Listen Gives the Boyfriend, hopefully, over the next year. How's that sound?
Sounds good to me.
Yeah, I hear that. All right, everybody. Well, we had Kimberly Jackson, also known as Miss Hot KJ. So thank you for being with us today. And we will have you back in a few weeks. And we're going to bring you out with Never Alone. Thank you, everyone.
All right.